Istanbul inspected the first shipment of Ukrainian grain that was brokered under a UN deal.
After Wednesday's inspection, the Razoni continued on its voyage to Lebanon to deliver 27,000 tons of corn.
But what effect will the shipments have on global food insecurity?
And so while it's good news and there's room for optimism, no one can think that just because the shipments have started up, things will get better. These will have lasting impact.
And later in the program, how sports academies are helping children displaced by war. Today is Wednesday, August 3rd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Today saw the first cargo ship inspected in Istanbul under a Turkey UN brokered deal with Ukraine and Russia to export millions of tons of grain trapped in Ukrainian ports. The agreement aims to free up 20 million tons of grain, and analysts see it as a key to easing skyrocketing food prices across the globe. Dorian Jones starts us off.
UN, Russian, Ukrainian, and Turkish inspectors boarded the Sierra Leone flag Razoni, anchored outside Istanbul Wednesday. The Razoni is the first ship to export Ukrainian grain under last month's Turkish UN brokered deal between Kyiv and Moscow. The deal requires all ships carrying Ukrainian grain be searched both going to and leaving Ukraine. After Wednesday's inspection, the Razoni continued on its voyage to Lebanon to deliver 27,000 tons of corn. The operation is run from a joint coordination center in Istanbul. The center is staffed by Turkish, Russian, Ukrainian defense officials, along with UN representatives. Speaking to reporters at the center Tuesday, Turkish Admiral Özcan Altunbulak said, with global hunger in the balance, they are aware of their responsibilities. He said the Turkish delegation will do its duty with the awareness that the world is watching. He said nations have undertaken an historic and humanitarian mission, and Turkey will continue to do its part. UN officials say they aim to export up to 5 million tons of grain a month from Ukraine. With world markets relying heavily on Ukrainian grain, the success of the agreement is key to easing soaring food prices. Political columnist Ilhan Uzgel of the Duvar news portal says the initial success of the grain agreement is a victory for Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, given his role in brokering the deal.
Erdogan grabbed a role, diplomatic, showing to the West that Turkey can be a useful actor in this region and mitigating the adverse effects of the food crisis globally. So he's playing it domestically and internationally.
Erdogan has faced criticism from some of his Western allies for maintaining close ties with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Erdogan is due to meet Putin Friday in the Russian Black Sea resort of Sochi, the second face-to-face encounter in a month. Erdogan says such close ties were essential in helping to broker the grain deal. Mesut Çarşın, a Turkish presidential advisor who teaches at Istanbul's Yeditepe University, says if the grain agreement succeeds, it could offer hope for a wider peace.
Rusya'nın %25'ini çıkardı işgal ettiği toprakları.
He says that with Russia invading 25% of Ukraine's territory, one could not achieve a ceasefire in these conditions. Çarşın says there must be a rational reconciliation and adds that this humanitarian food corridor can mark important progress towards softening Russia's stance and getting back to the table again. Analysts warn peace talks are unlikely anytime soon. Still, Ankara says its success in brokering a grain deal underlines how well placed it remains to facilitate an end to the conflict, if or when that opportunity arises. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky downplayed the importance of the first grain export shipment, saying that it was carrying only a fraction of the crop Kyiv must sell to help salvage its shattered economy. The downbeat comments via video to students in Australia on Wednesday came as the Razoni completed its inspection in Istanbul. Zelensky also said that he hopes that the shipments will continue and that the consequences of the war are horrible, not only for Ukraine, but the entire world. In Babda, Lebanon, Ukraine's ambassador to the country, Ihor Ostash, spoke to reporters, calling on the Lebanese government to stop a ship docked in a port that Kyiv says carries stolen Ukrainian grain.
As you know, General Prosecutor already closed the criminal case. Based on some research and investigation. But today we have much more documents, much more proofs, much more evidences, and we already sent to the Prosecutor General official request to reopen, renew this criminal case. It's very important to understand.
Moscow has previously denied stealing what Kyiv says is on the ship, and Ukrainian authorities say that the Laodicea traveled to a port in Russian-occupied Crimea, closed to international shipping, and that it took cargo on before sailing to Lebanon. The deal reached between the United Nations, Turkey, Russia, and Ukraine to resume grain shipments on the Black Sea was lauded as a step forward to combat the global food insecurity crisis, something that the World Bank says affects some 828 million people as of 2021. Dr. Bill Clemmer is a senior technical advisor for health, nutrition, and humanitarian programs at Chorus International, a non-governmental organization that works with communities to help them recover from natural and other disasters. He joins us via Skype. Dr. Clemmer, it's great to have you here on Flashpoint Ukraine. I was wondering if we could begin with this. You recently just returned from a trip from the North Africa and Middle East region, most often referred to as MENA. And I was wondering if you could explain to our listeners what you saw, what you experienced, what you observed while there.
Thanks, Steve. So much of the work that we do these days, that I do, in the Middle East is working with our local partners, with our Yemenese colleagues, doctors and nurses and public health persons. We're supporting mobile health services in 6 IDP camps and a very conflict-affected area in Marib, which is in the middle of Yemen. We're doing food security. We're basically providing cash assistance, food supplies to thousands of families that have been without food. But our work in the past decade in countries in the Middle East has largely focused on agriculture, food security, sustenance. With the current crisis, you know, more and more people, we seem to be going the wrong way. More and more people seem to be without food supplies, without sustenance. So a lot of our work is working with Yemenis, basically Somalian doctors and nurses, and not just the management of malnutrition, but basically modalities that they can do to help prevent malnutrition and sustain women and children and families. It's been much more challenging of late with the global crisis. You know, we know countries in the countries in North Africa as well as the Middle East have been hit hard by this current crisis, coming from COVID, where millions have lost their job. People have had a difficult time making ends meet, and you know the food crisis, the current food crisis, has affected the poor far, far more than others who spend a larger percentage of their income on food and food sources. So it's been a difficult, challenging time. In my nearly 30 years working on the African continent and in the region, I had hoped that at this juncture things would be better. And unfortunately, it seems, Steve, that we're not only going the wrong way, we're undoing a lot of the progress we've made in the past 5 to 6 years, and that's sobering.
And Dr. Clemmer, speaking of sobering news, Russia, Ukraine are often referred to as the world's breadbasket, supplying the clear majority of grain to the world. And the war since February has greatly impacted that. Now, as someone who works in the MENA region, the Middle East and North Africa region, can you maybe articulate what you've seen in the past half year or so being the impact that these halted grain shipments that just got underway earlier this week have had in the region, you know, in addition to COVID and the other factors that you've outlined?
Excellent question. I mean, there's no doubt, Steve, that anything's going to help. But the gap for months and months and months of missed shipment, when the World Food Program says that we can only deliver 50% of the rations from malnourished poor children this year, it's going to take them a long while to make up that gap. As I mentioned, you know, the lasting impact on children, lactating women, is huge. And so while it's good news and there's room for optimism, no one can think that just because the shipments have started up, things will get better. These will have lasting impact. I mentioned earlier 300,000 children in Somalia at risk of starvation. How long is it going to take for the grain to get to, you know? I mean, I realize there are other mitigating factors. The conflict in Yemen is multifactorial, but the lack of food, when David Beasley says that we're on the brink of a human disaster, I've seen part of that, and it's true. And it's so, in the part of the world that I work in, you know, many, many, many families get by on one meal a day, and many, many children go to bed hungry. And that shouldn't be that way. And it's got to take a while to get back to where we need to be.
Well, let's talk about that, because the World Bank put out this report, and it said that by its own estimates, in 2021, some 828 million people face food insecurity that year. But by their own research and then their own predictions, by 2030, that number should drop to 670 million, representing about 8% of the world population. That is a huge reduction, but it's also the same prediction that they had back in 2015. So over a 15-year period, there's a net zero reduction in those facing global food insecurity. So my question to you is this: what can be done to reduce it further?
I can only talk about what I see. And I see camps and settlements where hundreds of thousands of people rely upon WFP food rations. These are rations. These are bags of wheat, which women use to make bread, which is all that people have to live on. And when those rations, which have already been slight, are cut in half, I mean, that's what we're facing. I mean, as a medical doctor, this is not, you know, it's a huge challenge. So we're very pleased to you know, hear this news. But I believe that we will be hearing of the fallout from this crisis, Steve, for months, if not years, to come. It's going to take a long time to come back from where we were. And as I mentioned, a lot of the development gains that we've made in terms of equity and jobs and, you know, everything has been put off. We're now putting in safety nets where we had schools and development program and building farms and agriculture. We're now focusing on keeping people alive. And whereby that is the priority, I think back on all the projects and all the things that we did in the past five to 10 years, and those, as important as they are, they're not where our focus is. Our focus is on keeping people alive that simply do not have the resources or the foods.
Dr. Bill Clemmer is the Senior Technical Advisor for Health, Nutrition, and Humanitarian Programs at Chorus International. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Moscow has done its best to suppress opposition inside Russia. Anna Rice narrates that story.
On July 14th, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed two bills into law. The first was called on control over the activities of persons under foreign influence. The second, on amending the Criminal Code of the Russian Federation and the Code of Criminal Procedures of the Russian Federation. Kremlin watchers say the foreign influence law is vaguely worded and dramatically increases the government's power over Russian citizens and organizations.
Now, basically, anyone can be considered a foreign agent. What is foreign influence? Someone listened to VOA and they are under foreign influence.
The new laws expanded the list of foreign agents to include TV host Tatiana Lazareva, bloggers Maxim Katz and Veronika Bilotserkovskaya, and opposition member Ilya Yashin, who is in a detention facility for speaking out against the war in Ukraine.
Ilya Yashin is a known political activist, so a lot of attention is targeted at him. But we're also talking about dozens such cases.
From June 24th to July 24th alone, 13 new criminal cases were started around fake news distribution, 75 cases since the start of the war, and the law was only adopted in March.
The second law on criminal procedure that Putin signed on July 14th equates joining the enemy ranks during military activity to high treason with a maximum 20-year prison sentence.
In order to be accused of treason or being a spy, one doesn't even need to possess any sensitive information.
Vitoshkina says that since 2017, it's become a trend in Russia to accuse scientists of treason. In 2021, Viktor Kudryavtsev, a researcher at a Russian rocket and spacecraft center, died while under investigation. And Dmitry Kolker, a scientist from Novosibirsk, was arrested on suspicion of treason, taken from hospital to a detention facility, and died 4 days later of advanced pancreatic cancer.
I have a client. He's at a detention facility now. His name is Valery Kalugin, and he's turning 70 soon. In 2018, he took part in an international project authorized by the president. Part of the work included designing a supersonic plane, a civilian one, not military. A few years later, FSB comes to his home accusing him of treason.
The Russian government is presenting these legal changes as necessary measures to protect Moscow from foreign influence and to maintain national security during a time of war. VOA News, Washington.
Tensions between Jerusalem and Moscow are rising over a Russian attempt to close the Jewish Agency office in Moscow. The quasi-governmental Jewish Agency helps Jews immigrate to Israel, but Russia says it violates local laws by gathering information on Russian citizens. Israeli officials say they believe it has more to do with growing Israeli support for Ukraine. Linda Gradstein has that story.
More than 50,000 Russian and Ukrainian Jews have moved to Israel since the outbreak of war in Ukraine in late February. Many are anxious to leave Russia because of growing anti-Semitism, the economic crisis, and their worry that the repressive policies of the Soviet Union are coming back, says Rabbi Pinchas Goldschmidt, former chief rabbi of Moscow, who was forced into exile.
Reason number one is the fear of the closing of the Iron Curtain, meaning that one day in the near future, it will be impossible already to leave Russia. This fear exists by many members of the Russian Jewish community.
The wave of immigration is handled by the Jewish Agency, a quasi-governmental body that helps Jews from around the world move to Israel. But Russia recently threatened to close down the Jewish Agency's operations in Moscow and bring the organization to court, claiming that it violates Russian law by gathering information about Russian citizens. Russian pressure to close the office has more to do with politics than anything else, according to Natan Sharansky, former Soviet dissident and former director of the Jewish Agency.
Russia, which is almost fully isolated from the free world, is looking how to break its isolation. It's looking at how to press different countries. They are trying to press on Germany that people will start dying from cold in winter. And they are starting to press on us, among other things, for Jewish Agency.
Israeli analysts say Russia is not happy with new Prime Minister Yair Lapid's policy on the Ukraine war. His predecessor, Naftali Bennett, was careful not to criticize Russia and even flew to Moscow early in the war with an offer to mediate. Jonathan Dekel-Chen is a professor of history at Hebrew University in Jerusalem.
Yair Lapid, while he was still foreign minister and with the transition to the premiership, has pursued a less balanced approach. He has more clearly identified Russia as the aggressor. And it's mostly a difference in rhetorical approach than anything else. But in this conflict, rhetoric matters.
He says Russia is busy enough with the war in Ukraine and does not want a full-scale diplomatic confrontation with Israel. And it's likely that Russia will find a way to smooth over the tensions and continue to allow Russian Jews to emigrate. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And finally, with tens of thousands of displaced Ukrainians living in the western city of Lviv, local soccer, or as it's internationally known, football academies, are opening their doors to help them take their minds off the war. Omelian Oshudliak rounds us out.
10-year-old Timofey Slusar tries to keep fit. His previous coach just sent him a video of Mariupol Stadium, now destroyed by Russian shelling, where their Dnipro-based team used to compete.
We took second place there, lost in the final against Mariupol.
Beautiful stadium, wasn't it?
There was a roof, and now it's all collapsed.
In early March, they left their native town on the outskirts of Dnipro and traveled by train to the west, escaping advancing Russian forces. Timofey and his mother Svetlana feel comfortable in Lviv for the moment unless there are airstrikes. They attend football practices 3 times a week together. Timofey has been playing football since he was very young.
Once he turned 1 year old, he fell in love with the ball. We had balls instead of toys. The game means everything to him. We attended training every day, and even on Sunday morning, except for Saturday. On Saturday, we had tournaments.
This well-maintained stadium in Lviv, with brand-new artificial turf, is a place where local kids practice. Several Lviv's football academies, such as famous professional club Karpaty, invited children from displaced families to join practices for free.
We had over 45 children a week ago. Children from the east of Ukraine and the Kherson region remain. Now the outflow is starting a bit because Kyiv residents are returning home.
Usually a lot of parents attend practices together with the children. As far as I can tell, they like it. We can't turn away anyone.
Mark Kvasha arrived in Lviv from war-torn Severodonetsk. Mark's family moved to an industrial bomb shelter at a nitrogen plant where they stayed for 3 weeks before evacuating. Playing football helps him to fight anxiety caused by uncertainty.
In the bomb shelter and at home, I just sat, lay, and did nothing. I wanted to play, and here I finally was able to. It helps a lot to ease your mind.
Professional football season in Ukraine was scheduled to restart in early March. But now stadiums in Mariupol, Chernihiv, and many smaller arenas have been destroyed by shelling. Several of the active and former football players joined the Ukrainian army or territorial defense units and went to the front lines.
Our own Artur Hritsenko, who played for Karpaty, was killed in action. I knew him very well. It shocked me deeply. He lived in France, but came back home to fight. People are dying. Well, at least they're dying for their country. It is clear to me that we will win.
According to UNICEF, some 3 million Ukrainian children have been displaced by the Russian invasion of Ukraine and require assistance.
Omelian Oshudliak, VOA News, Lviv, Ukraine.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with the latest developments not only on Ukraine, but news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media feeds. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.